The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Wumen Khan. Bodhidharma and peace of mind, the main case. Bodhidharma sat in Zazen facing the wall. The second ancestor, who'd been standing in the snow, cut off his arm and said, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, my teacher, please give it peace." Bodhidharma said, "Bring the mind to me and I'll set it at rest." The second ancestor said, "I have searched for the mind and it is finally unattainable." Bodhidharma said, "I have thoroughly set it at rest for you." Commentary. The broken-toothed old foreigner proudly came over 100,000 miles across the sea. This was as if he was raising waves where there was no wind. Toward his end, Bodhidharma could enlighten only one disciple. Shisanro does not even know four characters. Wu Men's poem. Coming from the west and directly pointing, this great affair was caused by the transmission. The troublemaker who created a stir in Zen circles is, after all, you. Affirmations from the world around you. So this is one of the very sort of seminal or iconic koans in the tradition and sort of story of the step of Zen or Chan, Hueka being his disciple. He had three other disciples, and it's worth noting. One of those was Zongchur, who we, female ancestor that we chant regularly, who was born, who studied with Bodhidharma at the same time as Hueka, the second ancestor. And there's not a lot known about her, or the other two disciples for that matter, that studied with Bodhidharma. She was a daughter of Emperor Wu, the great Emperor Wu. There was another Emperor Wu that came later who was not so favorable towards Buddhism, but this is the Emperor Wu that Bodhidharma had his famous meeting with. And so she grew up really steeped in Buddhism because her father was such a devout practitioner and Buddhist. And so when she was 19, she asked to be ordained, which was actually a little underage for the convention of the time. And he said yes. And it said that she was sent to a convent built for noble women. So we can imagine what that might have been like. And interestingly, based on the scant information there is, and just taking it as reliable, she wasn't happy with how the living of the Dharma was there, so she left, and that's where she met Bodhidharma and became a student and studied with him for some years, wandering with him and eventually receiving the transmission. And after Bodhidharma died, it said that she settled and became a teacher and was very well known, and that her teaching was very simple, very little ceremony, really just emphasized Zazen. So as we're hearing about Hueka here, who's the ancestor that is most known about, we can sort of think of Dzongchur being there alongside. So we are practicing this path of liberation, which really demands the question, liberation. We speak of it as a path of awakening. Similarly, awakening from what? Into what? And so we can say to relieve all suffering, to be unhindered and free, to make our lives be one great offering. And these words are used, you know, living in the time that we do, you think of living at the time of the Buddha, the only Dharma words there were the ones that were spoken. Nothing was written down. And so the only time you heard about the Dharma was when it was being spoken live. And so in our time, we're, for practitioners, and to the extent that we choose to be, we can be saturated in words about the Dharma. And particularly these very essential words that communicate the most profound aspects of Buddha Dharma, liberation, awakening, suffering, compassion. And the danger is that the more we use them, the more tame they become. That in speaking them so frequently, ubiquitously, in so many ways and understandings, and sort of using them so liberally, that they become kind of domesticated. Of course, intellectual, conceptual, but domesticated. In other words, as I encounter this language, I see it being applied to pretty much anything. So anything that's got you down or that, you know, you're a little bit stuck with, you know, use a practice to liberate yourself from that. Well, it's not that that's entirely wrong, but it's using a term that has a very particular meaning. I don't know if it should be reserved for its ultimate meaning. Who am I to say? But when we use it, any language. So, I don't know, carelessly? It has an effect. That's my point. It has an effect. It changes things. What, after all, binds us? What frees us from that bondage? What do we need to understand? What do we need to do? What insights do we will actually help us to fulfill our vows? There's a book, this being the Hazy Moon Sesshin. Years ago, we had, I've told this story before, but years ago, we had named all of the Sesshins except the August Sesshin. And we just got stuck. Like, what are we going to call the August Sesshin? And the only thing people could think of was sweatbox, you know, hot box. It was all hot. I remember Fusho suggested August, the August Sesshin, as in that which is August. But we settled on the Hazy Moon, and there's a book that in the very, very early years, at Zen Center in Los Angeles, Mizuma Roshi and Bernie largely were responsible for producing, and it was an On Zen practice series. We may have copies of those in the library, yeah. And it's just a good, I mean, it's good Dharma, but it's also just a good window into very early teachings in the country, in this country. But one of those is the Hazy Moon, and in that, Mizuma Roshi sort of presents that as in terms of what is delusion and what is enlightenment. So I thought I would today and tomorrow sort of approach the talks from that direction. So in that, the introduction or preface to that book, Trungpa Rinpoche, who was quite on very close to Mizuma Roshi, they were had a lot of close contact. There's a story of that Tenshin, one of his Mizuma Roshi's heirs, tells in that film, And Now I Know You, in which Trungpa Rinpoche was visiting, and Mizuma Roshi was serving him. It was like being his jisha, and Roshi's students were a little upset about that, and they were like, Roshi, you know, you're our Roshi. Let us serve him. And he said, no. He said, he's the king. His job is to be the king. My job is to serve. So in that preface, Trungpa said, it's very soothing to talk about these things, liberation, enlightenment, non-duality. However, if there's no exertion and wakefulness, we are not even finger painting, but deceiving ourselves in the name of the Dharma. I feel the existence of the practice tradition is the only hope. It alone can liberate the confinement of the ego. It alone is the way that we can directly experience the Dharma. And of course, what he's pointing to is that within the whole of Buddhism, that there are there are different schools and different traditions and many different ways that people are Buddhist and relate to Buddhism and incorporate it into their lives. And when he's talking about the practice tradition, he's talking about what we do. He's talking about what his tradition did, which is basically doing, in essence, what the Buddha did. And in the vast body of wisdom teachings that come down to us, there are many stories about the journeys and obstacles and inner and outer struggles and realizations of practitioners since the time of the Buddha. The Buddha told his own story in several sutras. And some of those stories that come down to us are quite sort of reliably factual. Some of them are clearly blended with elaboration, and some of them are pretty clearly non-historical or non-factual. But all of those perspectives are only relevant to a certain extent for us, being in this practice tradition, to the extent that they serve to help us strengthen our faith and our inspiration and our confidence, to help motivate us to practice the Dharma, to make this a practice tradition in our own lives, so that we can do what has been done since the time of the Buddha, which is to directly make contact, intimate contact with the Dharma and liberate ourselves in the truest sense of what that means. And so the second ancestor, Hweka's story, is an example of that. And this comes from the Transmission of the Lamp, which is a very, very early collection of a lot of masters in different lineages, but all in the Zen tradition. And the older they are, the more apocryphal they are, and can be quite fantastic. But in this story, Hweka, as a young boy, he had a kind of an auspicious birth, as often is told. But as a young boy, it says his interests were not those of other children. And I just thought about how, for a lot of practitioners, there's a way in which it's not uncommon that people, you know, grew up, lived sort of more or less normal lives, and yet in certain ways might have felt a little bit like outsiders. Like the things that, I know this was true for me, that the things that sort of the streams that most people were sort of jumping into and following, the interests, the ways of going about growing up and living, didn't always resonate. We're not always one's path. And so it is said that of Hweka. He fairly early on grew very drawn to Buddhism, studied, became ordained. He says at the age of 32, after having traveled around and studied with other teachers, he began a very intensive sitting practice, sitting long days in meditation. And after 8 years, he had a sort of a vision in which it was said that he would receive the fruit of his striving. And that voice said, "Why do you remain here? The great way is not far from here. You should go to the south." And there are many, many stories in Buddhism about sort of divine interventions, if you will. And whether however we might believe those, whether it's intuition, whether it's a divine intervention, whether it's some contact from something hard to explain, it often is spoken of. And so he went to his teacher and told his teacher about this. And the next day, it said that his head started to hurt as though it was cut into two pieces. And his teacher wanted to sort of give him medicine. But he heard a voice in his mind saying, the bones are changing and reforming. This is not an ordinary pain. And his teacher examined his skull and saw that there were five bumps growing, five mountains. And so that was taken as an auspicious sign, and he then went to begin studying with Bodhidharma. And the story of that, of course, is well known, that he came to Bodhidharma after Bodhidharma had come to China and met with Emperor Wu, and then had gone to Shaolin Monastery and was basically sitting in solitude, and had been doing that for some long period of time in silence. And so Shen Kuang, which was his family name, came and stood outside the cave where Bodhidharma was, begging entry, asking to study with him. And Bodhidharma was non-responsive. And if you can imagine meeting Bodhidharma, right, how he's often depicted, right, you would think twice about interrupting his meditation, wouldn't you? Or maybe going to study with him at all. Not for the faint of heart. And Bodhidharma ignored him, it seems, and was unresponsive and just kept sitting. And so it said that Shen Kuang said, people of old have sought the way by breaking their bones and taking out the marrow, slashing their veins to feed hungry animals. He's spreading hairs to cover the muddy road in order to let the spiritual master pass. And these are all references to Jataka tales of the Buddha's earlier lives, in which these sort of giving up one's body and life for the Dharma or stories were told. And so he's contemplating this, and he's standing there in the cold, and he says, all through the ages people have behaved like this. Who am I to be impatient, to be demanding, to be expectant, right? That I should immediately be responded to. And so he just continued standing. And it said that on that night it snowed heavily, and he just stood there standing, and the snow piled up. And by the next morning, or at some point during the night, Bodhidharma, it said, took pity on him and said, what are you seeking standing in the snow all of this long time? And Shen Kuang broke into tears, and in tears said, please, Master, have mercy. Open the gate of nectar. Deliver the message that liberates sentient beings. Teach me the Dharma. And at this, Bodhidharma said, the supreme unequaled path of Buddha Dharma is accessible only after eons of striving to overcome the impossible and to bear what is so difficult to bear. How could a person like you, of small virtue, little wisdom, scant interest, and an easy and self-conceited mind, attain to the true way? Striving for it would just be an effort in vain. And it said, at this, Shen Kuang took out this knife and cut off his arm and presented it as an offering. And at that, Bodhidharma is said to have recognized that Shen Kuang was a good vessel of the Dharma, and said, all Buddhas in search of the way have begun by ignoring their bodies for the sake of the Dharma. Now you have cut off your arm in front of me. You may have the right disposition. And then he named him Hweka, and then said, what are you asking for? And Hweka said, may I hear about the Dharma seal of the Buddha? And Bodhidharma said, the Dharma seal is not something which can be heard about from others. And Hweka said, my mind is not yet at peace, teacher. Please set it at peace for me. And Bodhidharma said, bring me your mind then, and I will set it at peace. And Hweka came back after a long time and said, I have searched for it and searched for it, but in the end it is unobtainable. And Bodhidharma said, there, now, I have set it at rest for you. So the koan takes up that. Now, of course, in this story, and interestingly, I forgot to mention, Hweka Well, let me pass over on that. So, in these stories that are told and told over again and again and again, you know, the thing is why? What is the teaching here? What is being communicated? And so to look at this story, which is clear, again, whether it's, our concern is not for the factual nature of it, right? We can safely assume that Hweka did not actually cut off his arm, right? But we can also not find it hard to imagine that something like this happened, and actually has happened many, many times, where a student asks for the teaching or has to go through difficult travels or difficult journeys, or just to even begin a journey, has to go through considerable difficulty to find the teaching, to find a teacher. And then to be able to study, there are many stories of masters who just said, go away, I don't want any students, I'm not taking students. And the only ones we hear about are the students who persisted and persisted until they were finally, were granted entry. We don't hear about all the ones who said, oh, okay, sorry. And so here, Hweka is an example of an extremely strong bodhicitta who was undeterred by obstacles and who, in a moment of such obstacles, reflected on all that had come before him, all that others had had to go through. That's why the other day when I invoked, you know, our ancestors, known and unknown, and just think about all the incredible challenges that our ancestors had to go through just to encounter the Dharma, just to hear a teaching, just to come into contact in the presence of a teacher and be able to study. And so what does that do when somebody has to go through such hardships? What does that do internally for them? What kind of challenge of testing, of inquiry, of clarification, of resolve is necessarily being refined, being strengthened in order just simply to continue, right? And how fortunate we are, and we are fortunate, to have such sort of abundant access to the Dharma. And in that, there's also a possible danger, of it being so easy, and obtained so easily, it's very easy to take it for granted. Well, of course I can study for the Dharma. I can study the Dharma. If I want to, I can do it, right? I mean, isn't that kind of what we're taught, right? We can get what we want. And so if it comes easily, it can go easily. That's part of the role of commitment, is that when we commit, and that the longer we stay in it, and that the more invested, the more we have given of our body and life to something, the harder it is to just walk away when it gets tough, when it gets difficult, when it's not going our way. And it won't, by the way. It won't go your way. It won't go the way you want it to. That's pretty much assured. Because it isn't that kind of thing. And so how to reflect on this in our own way, in our own time. You know, Hweka was not doing this for our benefit. He wasn't doing this knowing a story about me is going to be told and it'll be inspirational and I'm going to be the hero. He was just desperate. That's why Shanti Deva says, upon firmly adopting the spirit of awakening, bodhicitta, a student of the Dharma should vigilantly strive not to neglect the training. Although one has made a commitment, it might be appropriate to reconsider whether or not to continue to do what might have been rashly undertaken and has not been well considered. In our own way, that's one of the essential functions of the Guardian Council. It's to slow things down, stop a person, and say, wait, are you rashly considering this? Have you actually thoughtfully reflected on what you're asking for? And in a sense, the Guardian Council knows, it's part of their responsibility to know, what the student themselves does not know. Because the student at that point can't know. Right? They're asking to enter. And so when the student is asking to enter, and the seniors are asking questions and probing, they're asking from that place of knowing what the student needs to be asking for. And are they? Needs to have within them functioning at least in a reasonable degree. And is that there? To help the student in the same way that Bodhidharma is doing this to help Hweka become very, very clear about what is at stake. Hweka's meeting Bodhidharma at that moment was the essential and necessary direction of his life. When he said, please, Master, your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. Please give it peace. This is a cry of urgency. This is not a casual thing. This is from deep within. I remember, you know, in working with koans for koan students, you know, there are koans that a student might feel a strong attraction to or feel a resonance with or connect with, and others that they don't, that they encounter and are just kind of dry, or they feel abstract or distant or cold. There's just no warmth or life. It's like, where do I find my way into this? And the thing about the koan is the student has to. They can't do it from a distance. They can't do it from outside. It can't be casual. They can't be indifferent. And so the koan is basically presenting the student each time with this. My mind is not at peace. Please set it at peace. And the koan is presented as a pathway, a doorway. And to the extent that that is true, the student will find their way in. And the koan will meet them. I remember when I came to this koan, having experienced other koans that were very difficult to find entry to, when I came to this koan, I thought, I have been waiting for you. You are speaking my mind. From within the cave of Huega's distress, he could only be doing this because he has confidence that there is a way through. We're not foolish. I mean, we are foolish in all kinds of ways. But a person is not going to put themselves in that place, go through that, unless they have confidence that there actually is a path through. Why else seek? Even though we're still ensconced within our attachments to pleasure and to ego and to success and security and knowing and all of that. And all of those are the things among the multitude of things that are going to need to be worn down, relinquished. I was reading an introduction to a text by an ancient teacher, and in the introduction, the authors, it was a translation group, and the author said, we're talking about the path as being fundamentally a path of renunciation, which often these days is equated with the monastic path. But they were saying, really, anybody who's genuinely encountering the Dharma to liberate their mind in the way that it's meant in Buddhism are engaging in a path of renunciation, necessarily. And they went on to say, challenging and revolutionary as this reorientation of personal values is, it derives from nothing more than an attentive observation of life itself. It grows from an awareness of life's manifest sorrows, birth, sickness, aging, death, meeting with what one fears, the loss of what one loves, the endless tale of human misery, that even if punctuated by temporary happiness and ephemeral pleasures, is as recurrent as it is inescapable. And yet, such are the self-protective mechanisms of the human psyche that through forgetfulness and make-believe and a pathetic resolve to remember only the good times, it habitually insulates itself from its real predicament. It does not want to face reality. It does not want to acknowledge those inescapable truths. It wants to wait. It wants to put them off. It wants to escape. It wants to make a deal. It wants to bargain. It wants to subdue. It wants to make believe. I love that because it's like that's what children do, right? They have make-believe lives. Not us. It should therefore come as no surprise that throughout any teaching, there's a repeated insistence on the need for practitioners to cultivate a persistent sense of the sadness and the weariness with regard to living in samsara. Just a basic sense of sadness and weariness. Oh, my Lord. It is exhausting. How could a person of small virtue, of little wisdom, of an easy and self-conceited mind? I believe that it's because Bodhidharma saw the depth of Huayca's sincerity, the strength of his willingness to endure what it was difficult, his clear demonstration of perseverance. He understood the potential of this student. And in the same vein, he might have also understood that this student might have had a very strong attachment to his sense of self, a very strong ego, possibly a very robust arrogance. It's very interesting. Right, those qualities. Right? And we think of arrogance as practitioners, we think of arrogance as sort of a resolutely negative quality. Or ambition as a sort of absolutely negative quality. No. Not necessarily. Because within those deluded qualities, for a sincere practitioner, there are positive roots. There's power there, right? So in a sense, the stronger those qualities show themselves, the more potential there is for transforming those into equally powerful qualities of generosity, compassion, and wisdom. And that's why those, the sort of the rough edges, the unskillful aspects of those qualities have to be worn down, right? So we talk about in practicing together mutual polishing, right? We bring in all of our rough edges and we bump up against each other, right? We bump up against each other. We irritate and annoy each other. We also inspire and serve each other, right? But there are all those little moments of judgment, of irritation, of annoyance, right? And did you come here to get everybody else in line? Did you come here to get everybody else in order? Probably not. And so those qualities are worn down, and then the good aspect of those qualities comes forth. And sometimes a very fine instrument is used to bring out those qualities. Sometimes it has to be a very blunt instrument. We can be thick-headed. Sometimes we just don't get the subtlety. And so those comfortable with great effort sometimes need to really develop patience. Those who are used to being comfortable will likely need to bring forth great effort and urgency. There's no fixed rule, no fixed form. And it's nothing is true all the time for any one person. Things are always changing. And so we take our seat, we turn the light around. We meet our own troubled waters. We practice again and again, not turning away, not turning away, having turned away. We practice enduring what is difficult to bear. We practice our own easy and self-conceited mind. In Buddhism, conceit is usually referring to just the clinging to the sense of self. It doesn't mean necessarily thinking we're a big shot. It's just that sense of attachment to I, to me. We meet our own. My mind is not yet at peace. And in the presence of that, we have to practice not withdrawing and not advancing. Because the waters will continue to churn as long as someone is running through them. And yet, this peace of mind that Weka is talking about is not just about being calm. It's not just about letting go of thoughts. It's not about having a quiet mind. Important though that is, because that gets to the surface and a little bit more, but it doesn't go all the way down. And so that's why Bodhidharma said, bring this mind that is not at peace out for me to see. So Hueco was consumed with his agitation, with his turbulence. And that is a very, very powerful and profoundly uncomfortable experience. In the commentary, Shibayama says, those who have not themselves had the experience of searching and training will naturally interpret these lines literally and will read in between the lines the spiritual agony of actual spiritual search. They will consequently fail to realize that there is an interval of painful dark nights for weeks, months, or years between Bodhidharma's demand, bring your mind to me and I will set it at rest, and Hueka's, I have searched for the mind and it is finally unattainable. The koan doesn't present that. That in between Bodhidharma's request and Hueka's response was assuredly weeks, months, or even years of Hueka's determined and resolute searching for this mind. He quotes Master Linji, who talked about, years ago, before I had any insight, I was in sheer darkness altogether. Hakuin said, I felt as if I was sitting in an ice cave, 10,000 miles thick. And Shibayama himself says, I shall never myself forget the spiritual struggle I had in sheer darkness. He says, I would declare that what is most important and invaluable in actual training is this experience that one goes through with the whole of your being. That is the fire burning on top of your head. That is practicing as though your life depends upon it. It's not philosophical. It's not abstract. And each person experiences their own searching, their own seeking, their own mind, and whatever is motivating them in their own way, right? So this is not a formula. This is not a portrait that everybody has to fit themselves into. And for some people, that they don't resonate with that. It's more just a practice of faith. They hear the Dharma, they know it's true without being able to explain it. And they practice on the basis of that faith. And that is a perfectly valid way to practice. What the koan is talking about is also a very real thing. And that within each person, those dark nights, they are universal. They are known throughout the world, not just in Buddhism, not by a long shot. And they are timeless. They are always fresh. And they are always born anew in the heart and the soul of the seeker. And the question really comes down to, how do we respond? How do we respond? Hueka came back after searching and says, I have searched and searched, but in the end, it is not attainable or it is unobtainable. And Bodhidharma says, now I have set it at rest. And at that moment, Hueka was enlightened. When he came back and said, I have searched and I cannot obtain this mind. He was just in that inability to find it. It was not clear yet. He was deep within that. His mind was not at peace. But he was so deep within that that when Bodhidharma said, there, I've set it at rest, he saw. And that moment is why this is a mystic path. That moment is why we cannot control. That moment is why the Buddha considered not teaching, because he said this Dharma is subtle and profound and it cannot be perceived or obtained by the senses. You cannot will it. You cannot just decide, I am going to have insight. I'm going to liberate my mind. And then just do it as a result of that. That there is some subtle, inexpressible, ineffable, unmeasurable, almost unpredictable shift that happens in that moment. That's why Dada Roshi used to liken it to the creative process, which is not just in the arts, but when there's a deep, deep searching and the agony that can come with that. And this can happen in many different disciplines, but not necessarily with the same transformational effects. But then when that, there's a moment of relaxation. And in that, because of that effort, that moment of relaxation opens, creates a softening. And that such a comment, a statement as Bodhidharma made, sometimes it just appears. There's now seeing what cannot be seen. There's directly experiencing what cannot be experienced because it's not a part. It's not something. Knowing it is unattainable is not having realized it. That's just having another fixed sense of mind. And that's why this koan, in a way, is difficult. Because in a way, it's quite indulgent because it just tells you the whole thing. It says too much, in a way. But it must. And so then the student has to find their way in through their own mind, which is not yet at peace, and forget about everything else. They have to forget about Hueka and Bodhidharma. There's nothing philosophical about this. They have to forget about it is finally unattainable. What they have to do is to do what Hueka did. And Hueka didn't know what was going to happen. He didn't know how this was going to turn out. to arrive at that place, as he says in the poem or the commentary, it's as if raising waves where there's no wind, that in that moment Weka realized that all along his mind was not at peace and there was nothing missing, nothing lacking. There was no essential problem. There was no reason for his mind to not be at peace other than the sense that it was not at peace. He realized that his mind fundamentally had never been disturbed. In a sense, he'd realized in that moment that all along, the troublemaker was, after all, him. And in that way, the troublemaking that we do, that is delusion and samsara, and can create a lot of pain and confusion for ourselves and others, is transformed into a good trouble, into a bodhisattva trouble. Suddenly all of that trouble becomes profoundly useful, profoundly free. Shibayama, commenting on that, points to Bodhidharma and says he's the troublemaker for having come over and teaching about dukkha and dissatisfaction and so on, and presenting a path which inevitably we will cling to, and talking about enlightenment which inevitably we will cling to. But how else? How else can we do what must be done? But I think we also have to understand that this troublemaker who's creating a stir in Zen circles is, after all, you. You. The you of you, the me of me. And so that's why teachers have spoken of sitting by the river and crying out for thirst, of holding a precious gem and claiming to be poor, of struggling with this mind and waiting for someone to save us. Struggling with ourselves, with our karma, and thinking something is wrong with me. Something is missing. Everybody else has it, but I don't. Other people can do this, but I can't. We think in terms of absolutes. You're either enlightened or you're deluded. You either have concentration or you don't. You're a good practitioner or you're a bad practitioner. You're making progress or you're not making progress. That's the mind that we are taught to see the world by. And when we apply that to practice, then you're either succeeding or you're failing. There are just two choices. When we free ourselves of that, then we realize we are walking a path that is a path. It is a continuum. That everything we look at within the practice has a spectrum. It is not on or off. It is not is or isn't. It is not you have it or you don't. It doesn't exist in that way. It is constantly coming into being. It is constantly appearing. And it has the potential to ceaselessly be getting stronger, be getting deeper, be getting clearer. That's its nature. That's the nature of how it will progress when we practice sincerely, when we train, and we continue to train. So that, as an old master said, it can all come down to this. For years I suffered in snow and frost. Now I'm startled at pussy willows falling. So simple. So present. And yet, arriving to this place, which was never anywhere else, there has to be a path, and that path has to be walked. This is what walking the path is.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.